How are you today?
The subject here this afternoon is radiation and health. The next three lectures concern that, its general aspect, and the role that organizations such as the Scientologists and so forth play in this field. As we speak of this, you should realize that on the face of Earth today, there is no solution for radiation. We're talking about an unsolved problem, one which has never been solved, and one which very well may never be solved. And on that very grim note, we proceed. Nuclear fission is an interesting subject. It concerns the Scientologist considerably. Why? Scientologist is quite interested in health. And where you have a radioactive atmosphere, you very probably have a declining health rate. Therefore, your people that you have in groups, your own pre-clears, the general public that you contact, and those people to whom we try to sell books or materials, are more out of communication. Their health aspects are not as good as they were. They are more tired. And if you've ever tried to interest a tired man, you can realize that he's a hard man to get into communication with. Now, tiredness, exhaustion, hopelessness all go hand in hand. These are the four horsemen of today, the inability to see any future. And if I tell you that one of the most important parts of human thinkingness is the ability to confront a future, or have a future, or find a future, and if I tell you at the same time that nuclear fission says to you, you will have no future, you can see at once that it has depressing mental aspects which have not been present in the world. Now, a man's future normally depends upon his own actions, his ability to get along with his fellows, his ability to do work, to make himself personable, to maintain his home, to raise his family. Not too long ago, in the southwest part of the United States, which is very heavily saturated with radiation at this time, a medical doctor, heretofore a very sane man, after an investigation of radiation and its effects on health and the way it influenced his future, shot and killed his five children, his wife, and committed suicide, since he said there would be no future for this race. This is fairly grim, isn't it? Not at all cheerful. Not at all cheerful. Hardly anybody knows anything about this thing at this time called nuclear fission. Hardly anybody has any idea of what it's doing. And there probably is its greatest menace. It is something that hangs in the air. Something which sneaks in upon you. Something which is touching you, and you know not of it. And therefore, we have man living in a mysterious world. He is getting sick from types of illnesses which his medical doctors do not glibly diagnose, but say this is gastroenteritis, certainly. But what kind of gastroenteritis, since we have never before seen it? The medical doctor tells him, well, I really don't know what's wrong with you. Maybe you just need a nerve tonic, cheer up, go back to work. And he has the idea, well, maybe this is radiation. Maybe it's radiation that's making me ill. And because he does not know, and because this cannot be proven, and because governments to date have been less than straightforward on this subject, that's no criticism of the government, it's just a scathing denunciation. There is no way to know what is taking place. In other words, a man raises a family. He looks at little kids running around. They're going to go to school. He goes to work every day to get money to support his family. He wants the little kids to be healthy. And they're sort of sick. He can't understand quite how or why. But one day he realizes that there's a high probability that these children will never grow to maturity, that they are growing into a world which will not be there. And he says, what's the use then? Why should I raise this family? Now, that's depressing, isn't it? And this is not a cheerful note at all we've started out on today. But cheerfulness is one thing, and fact and actuality is quite another. And I would never join the ranks of those who attempt to drive people into an hysteria simply for their own gratification or their political ambitions. Today, by and large, we're going to take up this subject very factually, very brutally, very bluntly, but at the same time, with this message, which will be stressed. The greatest danger of radiation is not small, invisible particles drifting through the air, but the hysteria, which is occasioned by the propaganda, the misunderstanding, and threat which accompanies it. That hysteria is the danger, not the particle. Because this hysteria can grow to such a peak that whole populaces can go entirely out of control of their own governments. There are two ways to go out of control. One is to get upset and go down and throw bricks through the Prime Minister's window or the White House. And there's quite another way. And that's simply to lie down and quit. And somebody comes along and says, here, here, here. These streets are dirty. Clean them. The fellow says, why? What's the use? There is no future. Somebody says to the school teachers, here, teach these children. She says, why teach them? They'll never live. And somebody says, this factory's wheels must turn. And the mechanics say, we're too tired. That is an aspect which the great powers that be have undoubtedly thought over very carefully. They are probably totally cognizant of this. They probably understand this perfectly. That's why they've stopped testing bombs. That's why they put out factual information concerning this. Russia is probably the foremost offender in this, since the Russian bomb has the interesting characteristic of having more raw gamma than other bombs. The U.S. has finally licked the problem to a large degree of the waste radiation in an explosion. To a large degree, this has been straightened out. They don't spray radiation all over the place to the degree that they did when they were first testing. That has been a direct result of testing, and they've got that licked now, and there's no real reason to go on testing, except perhaps to impress Russia. But on the other side, Russia has not so refined her bombs, and the amount of raw gamma which is being discharged is very serious. The bomb, in other words, is not just exploding as a bomb. It is three times as much gamma is being released by the bomb as it should be, you see. So that makes a very dangerous atmospheric condition. In the early stages of radiation, you will discover that the situation with regard to testing is quite serious, but as it goes on, this seriousness becomes minimal. In other words, there's less and less dangerous waste product. But in the manufacture of the bomb, a great deal of waste product is also developed. And right now, the biggest problem the American government, I think, cannot speak officially for the American government. Who can? Not even Dulles. The fact is they have a very amusing problem which is going on that nobody has been informed of, and they, I suppose, have labeled something or other. But they have forbidden the public health department to inspect atomic manufacturing sites now. Every one of these departments that could prevent them from doing something wild has now been forbidden to come near these various areas. And they are burying their waste products in deep holes. When they manufacture bombs, they have very hot waste products, you see. And these waste products have to be disposed of. So they dig deep holes, and they put the waste product in the hole. The public health department found out that they weren't digging enough holes, and they weren't digging them deep enough, and criticized them, and so the public health department has now been forbidden further inspection of bomb sites and areas. Well, there was an excellent political reason for this, is that the public health department furnished Adlai Stevenson with enough information to practically there for a moment, if there hadn't been another unfortunate international incident at the time, Adlai Stevenson's data received from the public health department very well might have run away with the election. So there was a political reason why the public health department was muzzled. But what's extremely funny is that they have not estimated properly what they do with these waste products, and they're in the ground, and they are turning into small volcanoes. They're man-made volcanoes. They dig a deep hole, you see, and they put the waste product in, and then they cover it all up thoroughly. Well, they haven't buried it deep enough, and so forth. All of a sudden, one day, why, splutter, 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 lava, you know, and other things start to run out of the place, and now it's not possible to handle it. So a nuclear physicist friend of mine the other day had the happy thought that maybe these volcanoes would spread far enough to simply eat up all of the atomic developments. Well, you might well ask what I know about this subject. It's amusing that I know anything about the subject, because the basic reason for working in the field of the mind, Scientology and Dianetics, was based upon the use to which this information was being put in the early 30s. I was a member of the first class in nuclear physics. We call it atomic and molecular phenomena then, of which nuclear physics, by the way, is only one small part. I was a member of the first class that taught this subject at George Washington University. Got the worst grades there. I mean, there were only one other person got worse grades than I, and he didn't take the course. That's because it was not at that time, and is not now, an open and shut subject. It permits speculation. Atomic and molecular phenomena is simply no more, no less than what do electrons and nuclei and so forth do when you do something to them. And that includes what happens to breadcrumbs when you throw them out, you know. But this whole subject was being grooved down, not by anybody's choice or selection, to a very forceful study of splitting the atom. And the splitting of the atom was at that time a fact. Everybody thinks the atomic bomb suddenly blew into our knowledge full-armed in 1943 or 45 or something like that, and then we bombed Japan. That's not true. The atomic bomb technology and so forth was developed rather fully for decades before anybody put it to use. It required somebody to sit down to a desk and write a check. The technology was there. But the money, the tremendous quantity of money necessary to develop nuclear physics, was not written. And it was a war which made that possible, and the check was written for $3 billion. And so we actually got a bomb manufacturer. But nearly all nuclear physicists, atomic and molecular phenomena boys, Buck Rogers boys, we were known as, Buck Rogers, the comic strip character, space opera and so forth, for all years between 32, let us say, and 1943, nobody had any use for a Buck Rogers boy. There was nothing he could be used for. He had no background that could be used in industry. The rocketry was completely flat. That was left up to the Germans and the Russians. Any field that he might have entered had no real use for him. So he either employed himself out as a civil engineer or some such thing, running a survey or something, or he turned to some other field of endeavor. So after I finished training, the Depression was on us in full, and it was obvious that the only use to which you could put this Buck Rogers information was, of course, science fiction. And like so many of the boys who studied in that field, I did. I wrote science fiction for years as the only use made of this material. And very interesting use it was, too. Developed tremendous numbers of friends in science fiction, and I also wrote other types of stories and made a very successful career out of it in the field of writing. But as far as nuclear physics is concerned, the only use I ever made of any of the material, directly and intimately, was to try to define the tiniest particle or wavelength of energy in this universe. I went out on this subject as a special subject on which I wished to base a thesis, and suddenly realized that I probably would find that small particle in the human mind. And I did a calculation. How is human memory stored? And developed a theory that was called the protein molecule theory of memory storage. And wrote this simply as a possibility, and then demonstrated later on in the thesis that it was an impossibility. The idea was that there are 2 to the 21st power binary digits of neurons in the brain. And each one of these, with 100 holes in it, would act as a storage battery for a human experience. And then I did a calculation and found out that if you took all of the perceptions and observations of a 3-month period and stored them, even this vast number of neurons, and the figure, by the way, would just right across the back wall here, you just go on column after column. You know, it's a big figure. You had taken enough memories in a 3-month period to have totally occupied this tremendous number of neurons. And obviously, mathematically, human memory was impossible. I asked around and I asked people if they could remember anything earlier than 3 months ago, and most of them could. And thereby decided that memory was not stored in little capsules in protein molecules. And this theory came back from Austria as an Austrian development and a fact, with exactly the same computations and with an error, which I made it. I always flunk mathematics. And there was a mathematical error in the paper, and it all came back from Austria in about 1938 as an Austrian theory, which I consider very important. But they didn't say it was unworkable. They said that is the way memory is stored. So obviously none of us can remember earlier than 3 months ago. When Russia and Austria speak on the subject of the mind, please listen, because they are the authorities we have known to date. And obviously we can't remember anything. But this search for the smallest particle led me over to the psychology department of the George Washington University, and I asked some what proved to be very embarrassing questions. I said, by the way, I said, in the psychology department, how do people think? Well, I was in the field of engineering. And in the field of engineering, you have somebody over who is a specialist in chemical material. And you go over and ask him a question, and he answers it. If he is the specialist and the expert, then he knows something about the subject. You go over and you ask somebody in the field of ceramics, what is so-and-so, and he answers you promptly. And with what a shock, I received the information after these embarrassing questions of mine that there was no department devoted to the human mind. They could tell me a great deal about the reactions of rats when put in mazes, but not how rats thought. And I said, now, what subject is this? And they said, well, this is psychology. And what are you doing over here from the engineering department? Get back in your kennel. And I was more persistent than that. And I said, well, what do you mean by psychology? And they said, well, it's like this. Psyche is a Greek word which means spirit. But we don't have anything to do with that. Well, here was, for my information, was a serious hole in man's culture. A very serious hole. They considered the mind a brain which had actions and reactions of various kinds. But as nearly as I could understand it, it must be a mathematical subject. It must be a subject which should be developed by observation of people and so on. And as far as I could discover, none of these things were being done. There wasn't anybody in the psychology department that could do more than add up a column of figures in arithmetic. They were not mathematicians. They did not know how to develop a theory mathematically and extrapolate it in such a way as to get a prediction of what the condition was. And I said, where did this subject come from? Oh, subject? Well, in Leipzig, Germany, back in 1879, there was a fellow by the name of Wundt, and he invented all this. I said, no, but who's contributed to it?
So what?
Well, it was invented by Wundt. Yes, but what did he invent? Where is his textbook? We don't have a copy. And I said, you know, a suspicion enters my mind that somebody is kidding somebody. And somebody is pretending to know about something about which nothing is known. And because I was an associate editor of the university paper and wrote some nasty articles on the subject, kidding them, you see, from the engineering department, about how the human mind was all wrapped up, coming out with their latest datum that if you starved a rat for 4 days, he died. And I then a bit got over my snide attitude. I said, this could be a serious thing. We are given to believe that the field of the mind is very definitely covered, that a great deal is known about it. And I have just been studying a subject which threatens to disturb the mental equilibrium of the world in future years. Nuclear physics. Someday, somebody will want to know something about the mind. And so I went on about my work. I studied. I eventually got a degree in the subject, whatever good that was. And as I wrote and lived and fought through the Second World War and so on, my attention was always over on this research project, and the materials just kept mounting up. And it seemed to me to become more and more necessary that man knows something about it. In view of the fact that some of my friends in World War II went a bit off their pins, I found out that there was some use for knowledge about the mind and thinkingness. I found basically that man is not a machine. However much he loves machinery, he is not a machine. Whatever man consists of, he is basically not evil. He is merely ignorant. And with these various findings came a considerable amount of technical information concerning man's reaction to various stimuli, electricity, his reaction to light, his reaction to smell, various types of reactions which culminate now in his reaction to nuclear fission. Now, that has been under study for all these years. I do have some background in the subject, possibly more background in the subject than people who are working solely in the field of the mind and have not been given enough mathematics or background in the field of radiation. But when the first beckon came my way during the war, somebody had been looking through the record books, and they found this fellow Hubbard, nuclear physicist. Where's he been? Oh, yeah, Hubbard. We're going to put you to work. We're going to put you to work manufacturing bombs. We're going to put you to work manufacturing bombs to kill women and children to destroy cities. And Hubbard said something rather astonishing. He said, he'll kill any man in a fair fight and has killed many in the ides of battle. But when it comes to slaughtering women and children and destroying the human race, you'd better go find yourself another boy. And I'll say this for my classmates, that although they went along with government projects and with these projects in the exigencies of war and battle, practically every one of them has now quit the ranks of bomb development. At their cost, at their professional degradation, nobody will use them, nobody will touch them. Some of these boys are now teaching mechanical engineering or something as an assistant instructor whose names were high in the rosters of atomic energy activities. And they are no longer with it. They are no longer part of these atomic projects. I have, if anything, merely the distinction of having refused first. The rest of them eventually refused. Look them over. Those that today that are not dead have all quit. And who are those people? Oppenheimer. He won't have anything to do with it. And so on down the list. These people say, this has gotten beyond scientific hands and has dropped into political hands. It is under the control of men who know nothing about it and who are basically irresponsible. And therefore, no scientist with any breath of humanity in him will have much to do with it. And that is the state of the world of atomic energy today. A nuclear physicist who knows his business is no longer part of this. Right at the end of World War II, to bring up a little bit more history here on the subject, if you'd be interested in it. Right at the end of World War II, a chap by the name of Johnny Arwine, Lieutenant Commander of the Coast Guard, and myself went to the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, to meet with a great many old-time atomic physicists who had been at the projects that dropped the original bomb, the people from Los Alamogordos, and it was our intention to organize these people so that some sort of sensible control could be monitored across the bomb. Nobody had thought about it this date, and Johnny and Arwine and I were still in uniform. Both of us had been in the world of engineering, and then in the world of arts, and then finally in the service, and neither one of us had had a thing to do with atomic fission in its development by our own choice. Both of us had refused this. And we were both shot up and feeling rather grim. We were still in uniform when we went down to Caltech, and we got these atomic physicists together. We said we were going to have a meeting. They remembered us, and they were very happy to talk to us. And the next thing you know, we did. We had a very vast number of atomic physicists there, and I took the chair, and Arwine addressed them. And we spoke of using a propaganda weapon against anyone who would use atomic fission further against the human race, of using any means we had to educate the people in the world concerning this. And the nuclear physicist was already so mad, he was already so furious, that Arwine and I could not control that meeting, even vaguely. We could keep them in their place, we could tell the next fellow to talk, but we couldn't get across any thought to them that was rationally workable. And these men said only one thing. We wish to overthrow the government of the United States by force. Now that is an astonishing little chapter in the field of nuclear physics that only a few of us know about. There was a revolt. And later on, you saw offices in the United States being opened to propagandize the public, and a movement led by Albert Einstein. And that was the outgrowth of that meeting. But all Arwine and I could manage to do at that meeting was say, guys, please, you people are talking in terms of mutiny, revolution. The only answer we'd get to it was, we'll develop a bomb so that every atomic physicist can have one, and nobody can arrest him, or we'll put this government in place. The idea of using this stuff on women and children. These fellows were mad. We withdrew our support and did what we could to knock the rough edges off the movement. We reported the findings of it to the Navy Department and the President. We said we could not associate our names with this organization. And it all fell to nothing. But the atomic physicist did try. That was his push. It took place late in the year of 1945 in the United States. And he's not going to do anything else. Why? Because his leaders are dead. Einstein is dead. And the other day I read the list of atomic scientists who are now amongst the graveyards. And it's practically the whole roster. Dead of what? Dead of leukemia, cancer, and the very things that the radiation sickness breeds. These fellows died to a marked degree of radiation, mostly, I suppose, mentally, because they had exerted a tremendous overt act against the world and had been unable to repair it in any way. Now, what I tell you is clear fact. It is not propaganda. I have no propaganda at all. I'm just telling you that there was a background where the nuclear physicist did attempt to revolt. The punishment taken against him was severe. None of the information I give you is even vaguely confidential. I'm not in possession of any confidential information of any kind. From that time on, from 1945 on, it seemed to be a lost cause. Some of us could see this. We knew it was coming. We knew that certainly the world was in danger from the fury of atomic war. But I'm afraid none of us were clever enough to realize that continued testing would take place, because that never occurred to any of us since it was stupid. And none of us counted on this factor, that the airs of Earth would be polluted with radiation to such a degree that people would become ill and maybe die out entirely. Now, that was not part of our understanding. And so, the only new thing that has happened here, has been simply that. A certain carelessness for public welfare has continued the testing of the atomic bomb. And that this may itself bring about a sufficient hysteria and upset on the part of the general public that government itself will become impossible. This is the extreme possibility. I do not believe that atomic fission will continue to be tested to a point where everybody dies. I do not believe that will happen. But I do believe it will continue to be tested to a point where everybody is so pronouncedly ill that a great deal of the ability is gone out of the society. Now, I'm not talking against the United States. The United States was simply the first to develop this. Since that time, it has gotten into even much more irresponsible hands in getting into Russian hands. I'm not talking against United States policy. I'm not talking against any of these things. I'm just telling you the history of it as I see it, and the consequences of it as they must become obvious in the coming years. Man has done an unfortunate thing, and for this he very well may pay a dreadful price. Now, that is a pretty grim look. I've done a lot of talking about radiation, but what is it? What is it? It is either a particle or a wavelength. These things become the fad and fashion like processes in Scientology. One moment, everybody says it's a wavelength. Next, they all say it's a particle. Next, they say it's a wavelength. They say it's a particle. This has been going on since 1932. And so let's define it as a capability of influencing matter. That's all. Let's just define it, radiation, as a capability of influencing matter. And that capability can be exerted across space. Now, you see, a bullet can influence matter, and other things can influence matter, and the only different definition that then we would make in atomic radiation would be it does it more so. You hit a man with a bullet and he dies. You spray him with radiation and he dies more slowly. But he dies. But the oddity is he does very, very specific and exact things in the process of his dying. He dies in a certain way. Now, the oddity of this is if you throw a handful of bullets at somebody, he doesn't particularly get upset. You know, they go, tack, tack, tack. You didn't fire them at him, you just threw a handful at him. Now, supposing tomorrow you threw another handful at him, now supposing the next day you threw another handful at him, and the next day you threw another handful at him, he would simply say, well, somebody every day throws bullets at me. See, the bullets aren't being fired, they're just being tossed at the fellow. They never add up to being shot with one bullet. You see that? They just never add up to that being shot with one bullet. Well, now that is the single difference in radiation. Today, we throw a few rays at somebody, and tomorrow we throw a few rays at somebody, same fellow, and the next day we throw a few rays at him, and the next day we throw a few rays at him, and the next day we throw a few rays at him, and he's been shot with a bullet. You get the idea? It's cumulative. And that's all it is. Now, exactly what it does and how it does it and the other things, you can go and listen to any nuclear physics, getting a technical lecture on the subject, and you can get all the information you want. There's all kinds of interesting bric-a-brac about it. But by the time you take uranium and refine it, you get an intolerant element known as plutonium. And if too much plutonium get smashed together with too much plutonium, it goes boom, and the gamma goes flying all around. Other elements are influenced, and so forth. It is an intolerant element. It is artificially manufactured, and it's very intolerant of itself. The way you make an atomic bomb is quite interesting. Anybody knows this. I mean, I don't know what all this secrecy is about. You take some plutonium. You take a piece of plutonium here and a piece of plutonium there, and you put a stick between them, see? and you fix the back piece of plutonium so that it'll slide up and hit the front piece of plutonium when the stick hits something. And then you simply throw the stick. The front piece of plutonium hits the ground, the back piece of plutonium hits the front piece of plutonium, and it goes. And that's a bomb. But when it goes, it releases a tremendous amount of gamma. It also releases many other items, much too lengthy to catalog. And these items, each one of them, in some separate way, might have a deadliness of its own. The various things that are used as containers for these bombs, such things as cobalt-60, things of that character, have the capability of killing people practically at a breath. So they've salted this thing up and made it a bit more deadly than it already is. But it's deadly enough, and all an atomic bomb is the method of getting plutonium to intolerate itself and go boom. Now, everybody knows that plutonium explodes. What they don't know is that it makes other things explode. So the plutonium, as a booster, can be put inside other elements, and you get such things as fusion. It's basically merely an atomic bomb. It's simply an atom bomb, the H-bomb. I don't know why they've suddenly started calling them H-bombs, because basically they are simply another set of elements which are triggered by the original explosion of plutonium. You're still not working without plutonium. Now, how much plutonium does it take? Well, it takes a few pennyweights. That's about all. This material I'm giving you, by the way, can be heard in any technical lecture by any nuclear physicist or person informed on the subject talking to the public at large. Or it's in the libraries, in the textbooks. It's a very common material, and it's not terribly important. What is important to you is that this bomb, when it explodes, leaves in the atmosphere a residue of what? Well, of gamma, of strontium-90. And several other elements, which cause a widespread coverage of the countryside with a deadly substance. And because it floats in the air, because it unites with dust particles, which then settle on the ground or still drift, it causes an air pollution, unlike TNT. And someone who comes along and tells you it shouldn't worry about the atom bomb simply because it is a large TNT bomb, really, is being very non-factual. Because atomic fission and TNT are not comparable. It is the blast, the burn, the fragments of TNT that do the injury. It is the radiation, the blast, the particles, the explosions, that do the injury of an atomic bomb. Something else is there. It is like TNT united with poison gas, which then does not dissipate or settle. So you can see it would be an entirely different thing to be bombed with TNT and poison gas than it would be simply to be bombed by a TNT bomb. You could get away with the TNT bomb, but the poison gas would stay in the air. Well, that's basically what this is all about. And what we're talking about is the residue of the exploded bomb when we speak about radiation in the air or air pollution. That's all we're talking about. We're just talking about this poison gas that blew out with the TNT explosion. Now, it stays in the air a very long time. They are now blowing atomic bombs up in such a way that they hope the residue will not come to Earth for another 10 years. This is their best solution. Let's blow it up so high that it won't come down for 10 years. I don't know what they figure out. I guess they figure not to. Maybe they figure to have taken a flat in Chelsea by that time. But that is the basic solution in how they're handling this radiation explosion factor. Now, whatever political purpose there is in exploding a bomb, it is quite certain that it is destructive. This we won't argue with. The continuous testing of bombs is destructive. It may have, however, in people's eyes, enough political connection, connotation, that they think it is necessary to go on testing them. They must go on, according to U.S. releases, evidently, they must go on releasing these things to keep people aware of the fact that they are possessed. Similarly, Russia is trying to keep in the picture and show people that she has an atomic bomb. In other words, we've got an arms race which is out in plain view, a bit different than simply building a battleship and sending it around the world. We explode a bomb and show we have one. Now, nobody's to be condemned for this, providing he does not understand at the same time that he is widely endangering health. Now, the government is actually of the opinion in Russia and the United States and other governments are of the opinion that not enough nuclear fission explosions have been done to date in order to damage the health of mankind. However, none of the releases which they have put out so far are convincing on this subject, and thus the public is not convinced. So we fall into two schools of thought on this subject. We fall into the thought of the government release and the public reaction. Now, the public reaction is best expressed by men of the press, and these have a tendency to fight back against the government release. The government says, well, although we don't know what the wrench and count must be in order to be fatal, we nevertheless feel, by experiments which we have not made, that the amount of radiation in the atmosphere at this time will not kill more than, or deform, or derange more than 6,000 babies in the coming year. Something like this. You know, awfully vague. So, and somebody gets hold of that in the press, and quite righteously he pokes it full of holes, and he says, what is your data? How do you know? What do you mean 6,000 babies aren't important, supposing one of them was yours? And he says this quite honestly and quite righteously. And he says to the government, release figures. But the government's on the spot. It doesn't have figures. But so is the press on the spot. It doesn't have figures. And out of this, what do we get? We get a tremendous question mark. Whether radiation is floating across the world or not is not the point. There's a question mark floating across the world. Is it or isn't it? But the funny part of it is that's radiation itself. Is it there or isn't it there? You know, it kills the human body very, very dead. But it'll go through a 16-foot wall. A gamma ray will go through a wall very easily. Well, what's it? How does it hurt a body? Nobody can tell you. A wall can't stop a gamma ray, but a body can. And we get down to our number one medical question. Gamma rays go through walls, but don't go through bodies. We get the density of a body and the density of the wall, and we find out the body is less dense than the wall. So therefore, we have to go into the field of the mind, if we can't go into the field of anatomy on this subject, and say, what is happening here? And I can tell you, fortunately, what is happening here. Resistance. The wall doesn't resist, and the body does. And a gamma ray does not really settle in the body. It goes on through. But its passage creates a sensation of some kind or another, which, if too recurrent, is resisted on the part of the cells and the body. And this resistance itself brings about the stop, chaos, that we see in no future. The reaction of the mind to the bomb is that we have no future here. Well, stop, the body says, stop the rays, stop the gamma ray, stop gamma. It's doing this all the time, isn't it? And finally it says, you know, I'm stopped. It sort of, this is very crudely stated, but it sort of works out that way. It gets, it feels this. There is some sensing of it. And sensing it, it then says, there's an influence around here which I must stop, which makes me in danger, which I cannot feel, see, taste, but it's doing something to me. I know it is doing something to me, and it upsets me and it influences me in some way, and therefore I must resist it in some fashion. And we get a body falling in. We get resistance definitely is called into effect there. The effects of radiation, very, very generally and very rapidly, effects of radiation are quite pronounced, are quite simple. They take many, many aspects. Hives, that's a simple aspect. They cause flushes, one kind or another. A person feels like he's sunburned. You get a skin irritation. Skin merely feels irritated. This is another manifestation. These are all separate manifestations, by the way. A body doesn't feel all of them. It feels one or another of them. There's gastroenteritis. A fellow gets colitis that he can't quite trace to anything, and he wonders what that is. There's an exhausted, achy feeling in the bones, which comes about from this. Glandular functions are deranged quite markedly, but we're talking about things that one would normally experience from just light radiation, and these categorized into hives, flushes, gastroenteritis, prickly sensations, exhaustion, a bit of nausea. You know, those are the mild light reactions. Now let's get into the serious reactions, and those all sum up to cancer. They sum up in this direction. Bone cancer, lung cancer, skin cancer, and so on. If a medical doctor inspected this very closely, he'd find that leukemia had an association also with cancer. Now, here is the very heaviest of these aspects of continual radiation, hammering and pounding, and these all add up to cancer. What's cancer add up to? Cancer merely says, we cannot go on. Procreation is from here on out impossible on a cellular level. The cells feel they can no longer procreate, and instead of procreating in cooperation with the body, they simply procreate in a wild and abandoned fashion in some other direction. In other words, they are driven to an independent action or reaction in the lines of growth. That is one type of cancer. And there are really two basic types. One of them is procreation, and the other one is simply erosive, corrosive, death of tissue, malignancy. Both of them are associated. Now, that's what man faces. Not much. Merely obliteration. There are other things, less important, less dramatic, which lie between the two effects. Now, some fellow doesn't feel tired, and then one day he starts feeling tired, and nothing has happened between the two moments. You, as an auditor, find he has a stuck visio at Trafalgar Square. In other words, he's holding a mental image picture at Trafalgar Square there. You say, what happened there? Nothing. This is his mental reaction. Nothing. Were you run over by a cab? Did somebody startle you? What are you doing holding up this mental image picture of Trafalgar Square in front of you? See? You ask him, close his eyes, what are you looking at? Trafalgar Square, he said. That's it. Nothing happened there that he can account for, and yet he's stuck in Trafalgar Square. Why? He got a blast of radiation at that point. Wind came around the corner. He stuck him. He can't account for it. Wherever you get one of these overwhelming mysteries, you get mental upset. Now, how is he going to react to this? He's going to someday get tired of being tired. He's going to feel, well, I'm going to die anyway, so I may as well do something desperate. I'm being told to do something, he feels. I'm being affected in some way, and I cannot account for it. How am I going to straighten this out? What am I supposed to do? Well, he can't do anything, so he gets sick. He gets various mental reactions to this. And the broadest of them is his first look at it, which is an hysteria. He feels that he should react, and he doesn't know which direction to react. That's the main problem. He cannot account for this effect upon himself. So he says to himself, there must be some accounting for it. So he assigns a cause to some other agency than radiation. You will sooner or later see him suddenly saying, well, actually, what's making us ill here in London's cats. Cats. If we just kill all the cats, we will be in good shape. There's no accounting for where this sudden enthusiasm came from for killing all the cats in London. But somebody got the idea. They said, the reason we don't feel well is the cats. They're carrying some disease. Or other, and so we'll just kill all cats. Somebody else will say, it's the government. Ever since we did that, it's the government that's doing this, and therefore we should kill off the government, or something, you see? Misassignment of cause. They say, well, actually, it's probably lorry gas. And you have people lying down on the street preventing any buses from moving in London. They're looking for cause. They can't find one, so they assign it rather ridiculously. Every time you get some kind of a national question mark of this character, a war is different. You know what to fight during a war. Rather interestingly, a chap at Pearl Harbor was on an old tug. The Japanese planes were coming over, and he simply told his men to pick up potatoes and throw them at the planes. He didn't have anybody get a bad mental reaction. The sailors stood there throwing potatoes at planes 300 and 400 feet above them that were diving into Battleship Row. They just stood there throwing potatoes. They knew what was wrong. They knew it was the airplanes and the bombs, you see. Now, if they couldn't do anything at all, they would have turned around and said, well, it was the captain's fault at this and that, and they finally wouldn't have found any real outlet for their expression of outrage. And having no outlet for it, they would then fictitiously assign this. And they would say, this is cause, that's cause. Because they cannot do anything to strike back against this thing called radiation, they are then liable to strike at things which are not connected with it. And so you would have a tumultuous, hard to control society. That's the only real danger in my mind of radiation at large at this time, because the United Nations and so forth may very well come up with some sort of a solution to put a brake on testing and so forth. But they don't act fast enough. Therefore, the primary problem that we face today is not the control of governments who are failing to control testing and radiation, but is actually the problem of continuing to control a populace which may get too tired to go on living or may revolt into an hysteria which defies any control. You see the beginnings of that right now in the newspapers and so forth, people becoming upset about radiation. Of course, we say, well, if we influenced these governments to stop this testing, and if we issued sensible information on the subject of radiation, and we really informed people what it was all about, why, that would be the sensible course. But I don't know that even we, at this time and place, can take a sensible course. But we have a secondary course, which is quite well open, and that is the control of civil populaces, problems appertaining thereto. How do you keep people fairly calm, cool, and collected in the face of this much danger and trouble? Because if you can keep them collected, if you can keep them braced up to it, if you can show them that it isn't going to wipe them out, if you can give them some hope of one kind or another, they will come through it where they otherwise would not. So the danger in the world today, in my opinion, is not the atomic radiation, which may or may not be flying through the air, but the hysteria occasioned by that question. Thank you.